Sprakkur, as you said, it is a very old Icelandic word. It means extraordinary woman. Even though it had fallen out of usage, wasn't that common, the fact that the language has a word that defines exclusively women in an exclusively positive way is something I think we can adopt in many different languages. Amongst people who identify as women, we all have a Sprakkie within us in some way, okay, where we can let our talents and light shine.
Welcome to the Her Career Podcast. Are you interested in current issues in business, science, politics, and society, specifically from a female perspective? Or would you like personal insights into the day-to-day work of people and companies that are facing up to social and economic changes? Well, you've come to the right place. What does Iceland have that Germany doesn't? Well, in terms of gender equality, Iceland is currently the world's top-ranking country. In comparison, Germany ranks at 9. That's not too shabby in terms of the global state of women's equality, but it's also not great for one of the richest countries in the world. So again, what is Iceland doing right? And could Germany and other countries use it as a blueprint for their own growth? In this episode, I'm welcoming Eliza Reid. She's a best-selling author, co-founder of the Iceland Writers Retreat, and former First Lady of Iceland. Eliza's perspective is rather unique. She's Canadian, but she's been representing Iceland and its women on an international stage. In her first book, Secrets of the Sprakkar, Iceland's Extraordinary Women and How They Are Changing the World, Eliza is exploring Iceland's women and their traditions. So let's have a conversation with her and find out what she's learned. Welcome, Eliza. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You've been for quite a while the First Lady of Iceland. You haven't been the First Lady since, I think, January this year.
About a year ago, August last year.
Yeah, so. How's that been? How's that year been? How has working life changed for you?
Well, I like to joke that I don't have to wear makeup as much. So that's something that I like. I mean, some things have changed and some things haven't. Our weekends are much freer than they used to be. We always had some kind of event on the weekends, different things. But I feel like otherwise my day-to-day life is just as busy. And I like that. I like being busy very much. So it's good to have my own projects and also to have sort of control a little bit more over which projects I'm taking on.
All right. And is, I don't really like the phrase, but is female empowerment still one of your priorities?
Definitely. I think it always will be until we get to more equality. And I don't think that's going to happen, you know, too right. soon, as much as I want to. Yes, I think I discovered my husband became president rather unexpectedly. It happened over just a couple of months and he'd never run for public office before. And all of a sudden I had this platform and I, you know, in life you get these unexpected moments. And you face these changes and this was a positive change. It wasn't a negative change, but it's still quite intimidating. And I really wanted that whole time to make use of that. And again, after these 8 wonderful years, when my husband's president, I want to build on that. I always say, you know, I'm not yet 50 years old. I feel like I have a lot more of my professional life. I don't want that to be kind of the peak of my professional life. I want to build on those networks and experiences that I've had. And that obviously gender equality, women's empowerment is a hugely important area for me. And I think an area where that experience will come to good use.
I've said in the intro, Iceland and Germany are doing quite well on a global scale when it comes to equality. You are now, I think, 16 years in a row in first place in the international comparison. Germany's just dropped to 10th place, I think, from 7th. We've always been, last couple of years, we've been migrating between 7th and 10th. So I think there's a consciousness of this issue, but you state in your book over and over, we're not there yet. There's still so much to do. Yet in Germany, we idolize what's happening in Iceland. I mean, we idolize all the Scandinavian countries, but Iceland seems to be a wonderful blueprint. So let's talk about that blueprint and let's talk about what's working out. So you now have a woman president, right? You have a female.
We did. We not only a woman president, that was, as you said, a woman who won the presidential election after my husband chose not to run for re-election. We also have a female prime minister. There are three political parties that form the government coalition right now, all of them led by women. We have a female bishop of the National Church, a female head of the police force, a female mayor of Reykjavik, and the heads of all of the parties forming the coalition in the capital of Reykjavik, and all the heads of the universities are all women.
My list also has a state prosecutor as also
quite
women.
Possibly.
That's amazing. So you've extended my list, but that is really, really impressive. I don't know if that's something that you can say for all of them, but are they all feminists?
Gosh, well, I don't want to speak for everybody, but I would assume so, only in the sense that I think that the word amongst women, at least the word feminism, I always hope doesn't carry the kind of very heavy political connotations that it carries in many places. I've always tried to use the word feminist a lot to define myself, because to me, I'm not trying to make a radical or crazy statement. To me, being a feminist means that I support equal opportunities for people regardless of their gender and equal things. It doesn't mean that I think that women are better than men for some reason. And so, yes, I would not want to put words in anyone's mouth, but I would think a great number of them are feminists.
I asked because I think that there's, at the moment, we have many successful women also in politics in Germany, but not all of them have stepped out of patriarchal mindsets, I would say.
Sure.
So what all these women definitely are is Sprakkar, right? So when we talk about your book and the secrets of the Sprakkar, all of these women would qualify. But who are the Sprakkar and what makes a Sprakkar in your own words?
So Sprakkar, as you said, it's an Icelandic word, as you may have guessed. It's the plural of the singular word spraki. And it is a very old Icelandic word. It means extraordinary woman, or sprakkar is extraordinary women. And I just to give you a tiny background on that, because when I was writing my book, Secrets of the Sprakkar, I wanted to incorporate an Icelandic word into the title in the way that sometimes you hear about the Danish concept of hygge, you know, this coziness, or the Finnish concept of sisu. I thought, let's find a good Icelandic word that we can kind of adopt into the English language or other languages. And I was really having a tough time finding the right word. And then a friend of a friend found this word, spraki, sprakkar, because it had really fallen out of usage. So my husband, who I would say has excellent Icelandic, had not heard of the word. And my mother-in-law, who was an Icelandic teacher, had not heard of the word. And then I ended up calling a center that we have of sort of Icelandic studies. And the director hadn't heard of the word. And then I got really nervous. But she looked it up. We have a lot of information on the history of language. And I think it had last been used, you know, 100 years ago in a poem or something. And I thought, well, this is a perfect word. We'll bring this back. Hopefully into more common usage. And I think it really says something, as I said, even though it had fallen out of usage, wasn't that common. The fact that the language has a word that defines exclusively women in an exclusively positive way is something I think we can adopt in many different languages. And again, it says extraordinary women, diligent women. And so I feel like we can adapt that in any kind of way. I think that amongst people who identify as women, we all have a spraki within us in some way where we can let our talents and light shine.
I think that idea is wonderful because there's so many words that will describe women in a negative or critical way, and there's no need to mention them. But I think a word that doesn't need an adjective to describe it in a positive, in a powerful way, in a meaningful way, I think it's very nice.
And I think I like your use of the word powerful, because we also have words that we think sound positive at first, and then we realize they're somehow infantilizing or sexualizing or minimizing women in some other way.
Ambitious women.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I just had this conversation with a friend yesterday talking about that word ambitious, because when we say it about a man, we say it in this sort of admiring way. And when we say it about women, it has this tone of like, she's overstepping her bounds.
Absolutely. She wants too much. Dude, she's taking up too much space. Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk a little bit about you in Iceland. So how was it possible for you to have four kids in 8 years? How is that possible?
I mean, aside from the physical possibilities, yes, exactly. All that works. You know, I've often said, I was born and raised in Canada. Mm. I moved to another country that does well in terms of gender equality. I moved to Iceland as an adult. And I'm quite sure that had I built my life in Canada, I wouldn't have had 4 children, mm-hmm. because I couldn't have afforded it. It would have been too much work to put together all of a life, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Because still, and also, you know, in Iceland, I think that in heterosexual relationships, it's still women who bear a lot of the brunt of that mental load, mm-hmm. right? Kind of, where am I finding the preschool for my children? And how am I remembering this? And do they need new boots this winter? And all of these things. In Iceland, it is it's a family-friendly society. Children are very welcome. So there's a kind of social dimension about the fact that people don't tend to be stigmatized for having children if you have children young or you go back to the workplace. But the crucial thing, I think, has to do with these structural policies in terms of supports that are provided. So there is parental leave that is paid for by the government to both parents, which is crucial. So the responsibility from an early age of kind of taking on some of that caregiving isn't left to a woman. Mm-hmm. It's constantly increasing. It was a total of 9 months between the two parents when I had my children. It's now up to a year. You can take longer at less fee. But, you know, essentially the idea is that one parent gets a number of months, the other parent gets a number of months. And then there's this third section that you can split a little bit. But one parent can't take all of it. And that's the crucial factor, which again means that most fathers take parental leave. And that helps even the playing field out. Yes. And then once people go back to work, and Iceland has the highest percentage of participation in the workforce of the OECD countries, mm-hmm. the childcare system is heavily subsidized as well. Again, you know, imperfect, and you can imagine in the media here all the debates about how qualified the teachers, when are the hours, how long is the waiting list, of course. But essentially, the idea is that it's meant to be provided from the age of 2, very, very, or often 1. School isn't compulsory until the age of 6. But those long years before, almost all children take part in that. And that, again, reduces a stigma of this idea of, oh, are your children in preschool? Oh, you're not home with them. That's it. You know, you don't see that kind of a stigma either. So I would say those are the big things. So, you know, we had our children 2 years apart. When I was on maternity leave with my youngest child, my oldest was starting the first year of elementary school when he was 6. Mm. And then I had 2 children who were in full-time preschool. But because it's so subsidized, it's so much cheaper when they're siblings, you would never think to not have them in school while you're at home with one of them. So I was very productive that year because I had the confidence of having had 4 children, but I only had 1 with me all day.
I mean, that's amazing. I've just had a conversation with a friend whose sister didn't get a place for her child in childcare because she had just given birth to her second child. So they said, you're at home anyway, so you don't need this space. I think that's a whole different in mindset, right? I think every woman, even if she only has 1 child, deserves for those hours that a child can be given away into care.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's good for the kids in a sense, right? In Iceland, it's called a leikskóli, which is mm-hmm. a play school. And mm-hmm. again, the emphasis isn't that they are learning musical instruments at the age of 2 or 15 languages. They're learning to interact mm-hmm. with each other and to play and to have yeah. fun. And that, of course, teaches a lot of skills, but the emphasis isn't on a sort of academic learning at that early stage either.
Right.
I mentioned some statistics in my book about, you know, divorce rates lower when parents have taken mm-hmm. parental leave, depression rates when the kids become teenagers are lower. And just that simple thing that, you know, when the kids wake up with a fever in the middle of the night or the flu or all these things that anyone with young children knows, they don't think, I only want my mom. Mm-hmm. They think I can have either of my parents, or, you know, very often that's the case. And I think that's good for role models as well. You know, 3 of my 4 children are boys, and I hope that they have grown up not thinking that the joys of parenthood and the responsibility of parenthood fall only on mothers, but that they can be excited about becoming fathers when they're older, if they want to be. And I think the other point, as you said about that societal change, you know, we talk a lot about policies, government changes, laws, and I've just given you a number of examples of the way that governments are subsidized and pay this leave. And of course, that's very important. But a lot of that shift is that person-to-person societal mindset. Mm-hmm. And so I think we can't forget, when we want to kind of do our part to change the world, that I always try to emphasize that it's more than just, say, voting for a political party that implements that, but actually making that societal mindset ourselves, because that is a place where we can all make a difference and all have that role. And I think men have a really important role to play in that, right? That's a parental leave, fatherhood is a huge area where we can really showcase the positive aspects of equality, right? Where we can give them a chance to, you know, I have yet to meet a dad that said, oh, I hated taking parental leave. That was the worst time. I didn't enjoy that at all. And I think that the more men that are speaking up, you know, they don't face that penalty of going back to work and earning lower salary, in a sense. The more that they talk about that and normalize that, I think that that's really important. And we women too, again, need to give them that space to not say, you know, oh, is that all they had for lunch today when you were on leave? Oh, I would have given them, you know, that again diminishes their contribution. And we all do things in different ways.
That's true. Let's talk about going back to work, because I was quite impressed. And you say that 77% of women are working. So only 36.9% of employed women work part-time in Iceland. Okay. It's 17% for the men in Iceland. In Germany, mm-hmm. it's 49% women work in part-time, yeah. and only 12% of men do. So this is where German women significantly reduce their pensions. Yeah. You know, I'm not talking just about mental health and what it means to be at home with the child all the time and work part-time and be short on time all the time. And burning the candle at both ends, but it also has significant effects on financial safety in old age. So how does that work in Iceland? Is it normal to come back to your old job? Are there incentives for employers? What do you do?
I say that sort of anecdotally, but again, I think a lot of people go back to their jobs. An advantage we have, again, kind of a small society. So you're not commuting to work for an hour and a half each day. But it's also because the schools have these after school programs, you know, and so they can be kind of occupied during the day. Now, a lot of it's built around having a two-parent household. So maybe one parent drops the child off and the other one picks them up. I can't remember now if it's Germany or regions of Germany or not, but certainly in other, you know, German speaking countries, there's sometimes where this tradition of like having 2-hour lunches from school or long periods of time when someone needs to be at home with the kids, right? So in theory, they're in school, but they're not in school. And again, that kind of discourages people from going into work and doing the work. I think you're absolutely right with the pensions. You know, it's something that I thought about a lot, serving as first lady, which is a voluntary job. So for 8 years, I wasn't contributing in the same way to my pension either. And there's been a legal change in Iceland to that. It doesn't have to do with having children, but couples, if they wish to, one point in their marriage, can pool their pension payments so that they would each earn the same pensions, you know, if they choose to do that as well.
Right. What I was actually surprised to read is that you don't shine when it comes to women in leadership position in the private sector, which to me is hard to understand when it works so well in politics, for example.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you know, we say we don't shine. We're not awful, but we're not in the top levels, as you said, in the sense that we are with other rankings, like women in politics. I know when I was first lady, I worked a lot with an initiative to highlight the promotion of women in these leadership positions. And we also have quotas and have had for a number of years on, say, the boards of publicly traded companies. So again, these were initiatives to kind of speed up that process, right? Because people would say, well, it's naturally going to happen. You know, we've got women are obviously just as well educated as men, if not better educated than men. So we can't say that, you know, that there aren't qualified women, and still it kind of wasn't happening. We also have these laws about equal pay for equal work. So why are we not seeing that reflected in the so-called C-suite, high executive offices and CEOs? And I think, you know, there's a complex answer. So I was involved a lot with an initiative. And when I say involved, I claim none of the credit for doing all the hard work, but I would just present the awards just before we do this. But companies and organizations, but also municipalities and charities could sign on to a pledge to achieve 40-60 or 60-40 gender balance on their senior management levels by 2027. And every year there would be a big ceremony where you would recognize the companies that achieved that and and acknowledge the companies that had signed on to that pledge. And I think part of that process is, again, this idea that, you know, you talk about it and people looking for, you know, they want to work for companies that have that as an ambition. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a bit of a snowball effect to it. And I think that's partially maybe why we see that in women in leadership. That's why role models are so important, because we have had female role models for a while in politics, in leadership, and that kind of builds on itself. You know, if we have these number, I mentioned all these women leading political parties, then people tend to vote not because they're being led by a woman, but because of the viewpoints of a political party, which is how we should have it, right? So, you know, I think it's just something that we need to continue to work at. And I think part of that is the sort of a boys club mentality, right? Mm-hmm. When we're looking to promote, when we're looking to hire, we think about people who are like us and whatever that is. And so we have to kind of be aware of those blind spots and really make a conscious choice. The slogan of that campaign is equality is a choice. And I think that's true. It doesn't happen of its own accord, or certainly not happens fast enough. Yeah. We have to really take conscious steps to sort of inch it forward in the right direction.
Yeah. And that's why reading your book and looking into the facts and figures, I felt that this is all a question of mindset. But we'll continue talking about that, because when you just mm-hmm. talked about the pledge, we have a similar thing in Germany. Many companies just pledged 0%. You know, they were only measured on whether they succeeded in reaching their pledges, but it was absolutely okay for them to pledge zero women on the board. It's fine by us. Wow. So yeah. Yay. And I think that's where the difference in mindset is.
There was something in Germany I saw, and I've traveled quite a few times to Germany to do these different talks places. And I'm always encouraged by that, because I think mm-hmm. that there really is an appetite among people to keep, you know, keep working towards things, keep doing things. And mm-hmm. I think that is encouraging, because even though, you know, the people watching this right now might be kind of already on board with the fundamental yes. ideas of what we're doing, I don't think I'm necessarily changing minds, but hopefully it injects a bit of enthusiasm, a bit of inspiration for people to know that you are not alone, and that slowly but surely it all is making a tiny difference, and that there is a lot of power in solidarity. And so, you know, I think I started to say, I can't remember when it was, but there was a big publication I saw where they were publishing the names of the German companies.
I think you mean the Albright Foundation. Is that what you were talking about?
Yes, probably that's it. Yeah.
Yes. They publish which companies have increased women in the pivotal positions and which have dropped down, and they send out letters to them, and they have like a traffic light mm-hmm. system, you know, you get a red envelope right. or a yellow envelope or a green envelope. It's very useful because it raises awareness. Do you reckon that the structural changes in Iceland are possible or are being implemented because there have always been more women in politics and they have more voice?
No, I would actually, I think there haven't always been more women in politics, is I guess the point. We also, you know, come from a patriarchal society. And I think if anything, that just shows us that change is possible. It isn't because it's always been this way. It's because we gradually realized that the more we can be equal, the better it is for everybody in the society. And there's a story I mentioned right near the end of the book, which is it's a well-known story in Iceland. I don't know how well-known it is everywhere else, about the day in 1975 when the country's women took the day off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's fun to mention now because this is the 50th anniversary of that women's day off, right? That happened in 1975 when a group of women thought, we've got to protest the wage inequalities, all kinds of inequalities that are going on. And at first they thought, why don't we just show people how society doesn't work? We're going to have a strike for a day. Other women said, oh, I want more equality, but I don't like the word strike. It to me is too leftist, or it's, you know, too aggressive. And so people said, okay, let's not do that. Let's call it a day off. And I say that's a small point in the whole thing, but I say that because it shows you that they were looking, they didn't kind of get bogged down in the weeds of the details of what they were doing. They looked at the bigger picture. And they decided in 1975, again, before social media, all these mass meetings, we're going to take the day off. It means you don't look after your children that day. You don't go to work. And if you want to gather and sing songs in the center of Reykjavik or in the center of the town, then you can do that. And 90% of the country's women took part in that day, and it made global headlines. What happens in a society when you take a day off? nothing happens, obviously, because women run the society. So men were trying to take their kids to work and it didn't work and the planes didn't run and the banks were closed and the newspapers couldn't print. So it really had an impact. And I think one of the biggest impacts was that it galvanized the population to know that we can all make a difference, that everybody can contribute. And it was after that that we saw more rapid change in society. So in 1980, 5 years later, we elected the world's first democratically elected female head of state. Mm-hmm. We had a female president for then for 16 years, an entire generation. But also they formed a women's list party in politics, first at the municipal level, then at the national level. And again, people said, oh, who's going to vote for a women's list? That doesn't matter. All of a sudden, they elected a number of MPs to parliament, which made that other parties started adding women to their lists. So, you know, these are, and then once they added women to their lists and they were represented more on municipality boards, then there was more support for childcare. Then there was more family-friendly policies. And so all of that started to build on itself. But it wasn't because we have a thousand-year history of equal representation at decision-making levels. It was really, you could almost say it was grassroots in that sense from those organizations, but it also just starts to build on itself. And so I think, again, that is an encouraging message for other organizations to say, look, it doesn't mean it can't happen because it hasn't happened yet.
I'm just thinking we just had a big incentive called Parity Now, which was trying to introduce a new law giving equal seats of parliament to women and men. And you naturally reached 46%, I think, mm-hmm. in your national parliament. We're at 35.7. Mm-hmm. And it failed. And I think partly it failed because it was such a long, winding process of getting online, logging on, writing the letter, signing the petition. So what does that tell me? I think we're not as open to these ideas, I think. It takes us more effort to make this extra step of saying, oh, yeah, but we want this. So mm-hmm. let's do it. Let's go out there. And my bubble's mm-hmm. been calling for a strike after your example for a long time. Yeah. And the documentary on your Women's Day Off was just released in Germany last year, and my internet bubble was full of calls for a day off in Germany.
I love that documentary. It's such a great. Well, yeah. You know, it's interesting. You talk about the 46% in parliament, which is true. We don't have a quota-led parliament. However, within political parties, many of those parties have their own either official or unofficial quotas for their party lists.
Right.
So many of those parties within them, say like the top number of our lists have to have gender balance. One of the parties actually had to switch, you know, promote men more because they had more women going up. But that's part of the reason why then it comes into parliament. But you raise an interesting point there where you talked about filling in the forms and the hassle and doing all this. And I think, and it's something that I noticed here in Iceland, and it might not surprise me a little bit in Germany as well, because you said you're in the top 10 here. So by comparison to the globe, mm-hmm. where women, you know, can't get an education, where sexual violence is kind of almost a state condoned mm-hmm. Use of things, where women aren't their rights aren't legally enshrined in laws, etc. Germany is doing okay. And I think that, in a sense, is a challenge for us in some of these countries, is the danger of complacency. It's that people think that things are kind of good enough. And I worry that people think good enough is good enough. And it isn't. We had another day off in 2023. Sometimes we have these regular days off to remind people that we have not yet achieved gender equality. And I remember I was asking people, so are you taking the day off? Are you going to town? And people said, oh, I'm not actually, I got to look after my kids. And I said, what about your husband? He's got such an important job. You know, he can't do it, or I can't do this. And I remember thinking, and I mean, that event was a success. Lots of people went, but you know, anecdotally who I spoke to, and I remember thinking, you know, these people, they have a decent job. They've got a good education. They aren't worried about their personal safety. It's fine for them, right? It's okay. And I kept thinking, but for all of the people who want to be there that day, who can't because they have three jobs that they might be fired from, because they live in an insecure home environment where they're worried about their safety or their children's safety. Those are the people who we need to go for, because those of us in a privileged situation have to remember that others aren't. And I think that is a challenge for many of us here in Iceland, and probably also in Germany, is to kind of kick that complacency to say, you know, it is probably fine for you. Maybe you do have a job and it's fine. And yeah, you earn a bit less than your husband earns, or, you know, you have to remember all the birthdays and they don't. But Isn't that just okay? You know, why do I need to kind of put my neck out? And I think that that is a challenge. The closer that we get to achieving this is to remember how important it is, and how important it is for so many people who aren't able to speak up about it, right? Or who are facing, as you said, that, you know, gender-based violence is a huge example. In Iceland, obviously, you know, our women's shelter is full of people, and there's still crises of gender-based violence, and, you know, victims of femicide. And if, you know, how can, what can we say that we're doing so well in the world when, you know, we have a society that allows that, in, you know, even if it doesn't kind of legally allow it, right? So I think that that is something, and it combating complacency is a challenge, because it has to do with convincing everybody that it is worth our time and our energy, even when we have a lot of demands in our time and our energy. And, you know, we've changed. I mean, as you, we could have this dialogue forever, of course. You know, we talked about women's empowerment and how, you know, many of us teach our daughters, you can do anything and you can be everything. But have we changed how we're raising our men and what a quote unquote real man is like? And we still have this kind of narrow definition of manliness and where men fit into society. And I think that there is kind of a crisis as well for them, that if they don't fit into this very narrow box, then they don't feel like they necessarily have a place or belonging, which makes them want to figure out, who do I blame for not having that sense of belonging or not have that entitlement that I thought that I should have. And I think that we do need to maintain, when it's coming to gender equality, like room for dialogue to make sure that people can contribute and everybody feels like they have an opportunity, because the statistics tell us and the data tell us that more gender equal societies are better for men too, of course. And men are happier. Men are more peaceful. Men live longer lives in more gender equal societies. But if they don't believe that, then we need to look at that, because there is still a very strong perception that this is a women's only issue.
Yes.
And, and you know, yeah, we've got a lot to gain. We're a lot farther behind in a lot of areas. But we need allies too.
What really struck me was your chapter on sexuality and bodily determination and also queerness, because I think this is where it's hard for people who are almost there in saying, yes, women should have equal rights, but then we don't get to the intersectionality of it. You know, we're not there. We still need to talk about migrants and people with different abilities and people with, who are neurodivergent, LGBTQ community, all kinds of people. That chapter made me happy that this whole three in the morning, thing.
Quarter to three culture.
Women not being blamed for living out their sexuality. Can you tell us more about that? How does, I mean, it's hard to believe.
I found it hard to believe too, you know, and I, as I said, born and raised in Canada. So the fact that I was writing this chapter about sex, I was like, my mother's going to read this. And so, you know, I have to get over my own prejudices and qualms about this, which I would say I absolutely have, you know, have been raised in a different culture. But to me, it was a noticeable thing when I moved to Iceland. Again, it's imperfect, but certainly a much more liberal, and I would probably hazard a kind of Nordic overall guess, open-minded approach to sexuality and sex in general. And that has to do with, you know, in Iceland, most people aren't married when they have children. There isn't any stigma towards single mothers. There's a, you know, and again, that has to do with that power dynamic that you mentioned before, right? That like men are sort of seen to be like sowing their wild oats as part of a culture of being a man. And then why can't women do that as well? And I think that's sort of an important dimension. So yeah, in the book, which is kind of broken down in different, you know, facets of society. And that was something that was really important for me to talk about. But so, as you said, one is the queer dimension, you know, both the LGBTQ community, the trans community. And I think overall, all facets of intersectionality we need to look at. And again, I also confess, you know, I started writing this book, I was thinking, intersectionality, it's such a like technical kind of jargony word. And I really wanted to write a book that wasn't super data heavy, you know, that was an everyday book for people that you'd finish reading and think it was funny in places and kind of be inspired, and not that it was this like angry ranting and raving data driven book. And then, you know, I can't think of a different word other than intersectionality, which I found is just personally an intimidating word, you know, if you're not kind of a specialist in this area. But that to me is just that importance of recognizing that you know, my experience as a white, educated, heterosexually able-bodied woman is going to be different than somebody else's with different things, and that we all need to be aware of that. And I hope that that makes it more accessible, right? I think all of us want, or I hope that many of us, you know, we want to be open-minded. We want to try to remember that. And we all have our own blind spots, obviously. And so we have to have room in that dialogue for kind of acknowledging those blind spots and working to fix them, but acknowledging that other people will too. And that's kind of part of the dialogue. There's one other point that I'll mention that kind of, you just sort of sparked an idea in me when you were talking about that, when you talked about solidarity or talking about different things. And it's just a general point that I would bring up, because you know, you mentioned at the beginning, all these women in Iceland, here we are talking about Iceland, giving you some examples. We've got all these women in leadership positions in Iceland, right? So you could have talked to a great number of people. And here you're talking to me, who served kind of in an unofficial position that I wasn't elected to, that really I got this platform because of something my husband did, which is quite ironic when it comes to gender equality. And I think took me personally a little while to get over, because I thought, I'm not allowed to talk about this because I don't have it's not a real position. And I can't, and women were kind of told not to rock the boat and not to do anything different. And I wrote a book about it because I thought it's important to say, look, you don't have to be the president or the prime minister. You have a great platform then to do that. But we all have an obligation to speak up, and we all have an obligation to kind of use our networks and our platforms. And so it's taken me a while, you know, but I feel like to get over that imposter syndrome that I had of thinking, I don't have a right to talk about this because I'm not one of the people with a title that I've earned, you know, actually helps me to talk to other people and say, don't wait for that title that you've earned. And I mean, I'll be the first one to say, run for office and become president, become prime minister and do all those things, please. But also don't wait for it. You know, don't wait for somebody else to give you the stamp of approval of what you can talk about or not. We all have that need to use our voices.
I wrote down on the side of the page, I wrote down no shame, no bullshit mentality, because that's sort of how I summarized in my head. There's like a commitment to togetherness, and maybe that's island culture. I don't know. Maybe that comes with
solidarity. Know, maybe the sort of bigger picture solidarity,
maybe,
I would say.
Yeah, maybe there's a commitment to your fellow humans that's different.
Yeah, I mean, Icelandic society, I would say, is very direct, is a kind of no bullshit society. But I think German society is quite direct as well, in the limited amount that I know. But I did make several trips first. I always loved visiting Germany, a kind of direct, sort of unapologetic. And obviously, I mean, well, Germany, I mean, you have such a diverse, you know, it's a diverse group of cultures and histories and backgrounds there that are kind of merging, which, you know, brings challenges, but also brings opportunities, right? Because you have these different histories and perspectives. Mm. And one of the things that I've often heard discussed in the German context, when I've been speaking, is the fact that, you know, when there was East Germany and West Germany, then East Germany, everybody from East Germany grew up with mothers working outside the home. I mean, that was just a complete norm. So less of a challenge there, in a sense, to get over this idea of having two parents working full time outside the home, whereas other places maybe have had to overcome more of that sort of thing. Anyway, I feel like I get so excited about this topic, I start going off on all these tangents. It's fun to talk about.
Yeah, it's cool. It's absolutely fine. I think you're absolutely right, and I think it's no surprise that Angela Merkel was born and raised in Eastern Germany. I think that's no surprise. But yeah, let's talk. You've mentioned it earlier about representation and role models, and you say it in the book on several occasions that the fact that Iceland is so small brings you much closer to role models from arts and sports and TV and media. You meet them at the supermarket. And do you think that if you see them in real life and they're actually tangible, girls, women, boys even, you know, are more inspired because it seems more real?
I think that small to me, that closeness helps. But also just in terms of reality, you think, oh, I run into that, you know, pop star at the grocery store, or our kids are together. It makes you think, I could be a pop star. That's not something that people in outer space or people in this other world pursue. So in that sense, I think it's important. And I think it's a great opportunity actually for people in all facets of society. So not necessarily political leaders or leaders of companies, but people who are well known in whatever field to be able to be role models and have an influence in that sense as well, you know, that they can show that they're positive. I know that our kids all played football, you know, at different ages, and there would be these overnight football tournaments, and my husband would always go with them and stay overnight with them. And of course, and was like, oh, the president's here, and he'd be doing all these photos. And I remember that our kids used to love it. There was a really well-known pop star here who had a child the same age. And they'd say, oh, every time he was there, that was great because fewer people went to, you know, the president and more people went to the pop star. But it was just kind of, yeah, there's something kind of nice and relatable about it then as well, you know, that you can connect to it. I think that's an advantage. But, you know, in as you said, like in big countries, of course, people become nationally known, but I'm sure there's also people who are locally known as well. And I think we see that with many, you know, sports stars as well. They do their work, you know, at hospitals, and I think many of them do a really good job of trying to be kind of accessible to the community and taking their role as role models seriously, which is really nice to see.
Coming back, when I told people that I would be speaking to you and talking about what, you know, what does Iceland do that Germany doesn't do, or what do they have that we don't have, many people said to me, yeah, you know, it's a small country. And they said the same thing about New Zealand during the COVID crisis. You know, they did so well. Well, it's an island and it's a small country. And I don't think that's true. I don't want to believe that, because I believe if something is structural, it will work no matter the size. What's your view on that?
I hear the same thing too. I hear you're a small country and you're a homogeneous country. I always push back on the homogeneous part as well, because we're actually much more ethnically diverse than people think that we are. We have a lot of foreign-born population. And then when it comes to the size, I mean, sure, there are advantages of being small. And in some senses, one of the biggest ones, you can see the results of those changes sooner, right? So not to the quality. If you're a company and you're starting a new product, you can test it out and you can see what happens. On the other hand, bigger countries have more money straight up. Like they have just more money, more tax revenue, more things to investigate. They have more voices, more different perspectives, opinions, energy. You know, they're bigger. They've got more. So they can, if they choose to, can choose to be a powerhouse in these areas. So I think it's a little bit of an easy answer to say, oh, you're small and, you know, and therefore it makes it easier.
If we were to summarize, what are the secrets of the Splakar? What do you think makes it different?
Well, I feel like I'm kind of telling you the murderer of a murder mystery or something. You know, like the book's called The Secrets of the Splakar. I hope people read the book anyway, because I hope it's fun and inspiring. But The Secrets of the Splakar is kind of that even though Splakar is an Icelandic word, it's not an Icelandic concept. And that Sprakar and outstanding women is not something that is unique to our Nordic island, but that there are outstanding, inspirational women who are role models everywhere. And what we all have an obligation to is to elevate those voices, to make sure that people are using their voices, and to remember that we are all role models. So the point again, it's not to celebrate the most famous women that we all know. It's to celebrate and remind us all that we have an opportunity to do something here that will kind of nudge things in the right direction.
Been in a position with a big platform. You've sort of stepped down from this platform now, but you're still an entrepreneur. You're still a mother. You're still a public person. How are you going to continue making your mark as Eliza Reid, not the first lady, but...
Yeah. So I guess a few things, you know, I'm quite well. I do lots of different things within Iceland here. Abroad, I'm continuing writing as a personal challenge. I wrote a fiction book, which is a murder mystery. So, but it's kind of a feminist murder mystery. I think I would say it has a leading character. It's coming out in German next year. So I'm finishing up then the second book in that series. I also have a memoir coming out next year in English. Hopefully it will come out in German at some point, all about serving as First Lady of Iceland. And the theme behind that is to remind people, you know, I grew up on a farm in Canada. As I said, it's a remarkable story, how my husband became president, and that to remind people to make the most of the unexpected moments in life. And I'm doing a lot of public speaking. So I'm traveling a lot to talk about storytelling for social change, to talk about Iceland's women, to talk about, you know, my own story and how to make the most of those unexpected moments in life and kind of lean into the uncomfortable feeling that we all encounter sometimes. So I have a lot of fun doing that. I love Iceland. I love telling stories and talking. And so it's been really fun to get to travel to different places and share some of those stories with interesting slides and that sort of thing for people. And hopefully just give people a bit of galvanizing inspiration to believe that we can all make a difference, because I really believe that.
So with good conscience, you and I can say that you are also a Sprakar.
Oh, thank you very much. And likewise.
is that a title that you would give yourself?
Someone gave me a t-shirt recently that has Spracky written all over it, you know. If I'm in a kind of boastful mood, I hope so, yeah.
Thank you for joining us. If you've enjoyed this episode, please click the like button and recommend us to others. Or better yet, subscribe to the podcast now. If you would like to find out more about Her Career, visit us online at her-career.com or subscribe to the newsletter at her-career.com/newsletter. This will keep you informed about new content such as Her Career Academies, our latest podcast episodes, and program highlights from the upcoming Her Career Expo in Munich. We look forward to welcoming you to our network.